7. Across the dark wood of the conference room table, Wells asked the questions, every once in a while, sparing the data pad in front of him a quick look. Mark had no idea what he was checking, but the camera in the corner of the far wall had him fixed in its sights, and there was no way to know what other devices were in the room as well, watching him for any tells. The room looked ordinary enough, but when no one spoke, the flat way the silence lay there showed the falseness of it. The walls were soundproofed, the windows inch-thick armoured polymer. The reproduction of a Turner painting on the wall was probably studded with listening devices, and the speckled foam tiles in the ceiling could be hiding a myriad of scanners looking at skin temperature, voice stressors, eye-blink ratios, the lot. The room was an interrogation space hiding behind the veneer of civility. No bare concrete walls and steel chairs bolted to the floor here, no harsh spotlights and cell doors, although MI6 had those kind of rooms as well, if you went deep enough. This place was supposed to make Mark feel like he wasn't a prisoner, but even though they had dressed the wound on his arm and done away with the cuffs, he didn't buy it. Wells made him go through it all a third time. It was a classic interrogation technique, forcing repetition out of a suspect in order to find the places where the story didn't match up. Wells was looking for the breaks in Mark's narrative, but all he had was the truth. Most of it, anyhow. Careful who you trust. Mark remembered Sam's words at the dockside, and he kept that tiny fragment of events to himself. Wells had a reputation throughout the service as a man who looked for notches to put on his belt, for expedient choices that weren't necessarily the right ones. Mark had no intention of placing his faith in a man like that. He had to get through this, find someone he could confide in. His reverie broke with a start as Wells tossed something metallic and heavy onto the desk, where it landed with a solid thud. It was the gunman's Sig Sauer semi-automatic, now wrapped in a plastic evidence bag. "I'd appreciate it if you paid attention," Wells was saying. He nodded at the pistol. "Where did you get this?"
"I told you," he said wearily. "I took it from the man who tried to kill me."
Wells glanced at his pad, consulting his notes.
"But you left the grenade launcher, though. Why, too conspicuous?"
"Don't take the piss," Mark growled, and immediately regretted it.
The other man smiled slightly, as if he had scored a minor victory. Then the smile went away.
"Technical are chasing down the details as we speak, but this weapon appears to be part of a shipment sold by a Lithuanian arms dealer. It's not the kind of thing a British intelligence officer should have on him."
"He's must," Mark shot back. "I was running for my life. I had to defend myself."
Wells checked his notes again.
"Which is why you killed this mystery man and then made sure his body and his vehicle were set alight so there would be little evidence left behind."
"We had our orders," Mark muttered. "The French police were in the area. Hub White wanted zero traces."
"Zero traces? Is that what you call setting fire to a car with a corpse in the boot? And of course now we can't get anyone near the remains to verify what you're telling me."
Mark showed teeth.
"I didn't have a lot of choice in the matter."
That got him a slow, considered nod.
"It must have been difficult for you. The kill, I mean. Your first time hand to hand like that."
"What?" The reply wrong-footed him. Yes, it was."
Wells went on as if he hadn't spoken.
"I mean, you're not a field officer. You're not rated to go directly in harm's way, are you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Just making an observation. Because you had the opportunity to take on that role and you turned it down, am I right?"
Despite his weariness, Mark felt his hands tense into fists.
"How is that relevant?"
"It's relevant because to understand these events, I have to understand you." The other man's manner shifted, the faux conversational tone dropping away to reveal a flinty edge beneath.
"You were there, and you came through it alive when 7 other officers did not. Officers who were much better trained than you. That automatically makes you very, very relevant, Dane."
A fist of icy cold was forming in Mark's stomach.
"I'm alive and here and talking to you because of blind stupid luck.
Don't sell yourself short."
The casual manner returned for a moment.
"You showed real initiative.
We confirmed your illegal crossing at Dover with the border agency. Very smart move.
Mark went on. You're talking to me like you're responsible.
Wells snapped. At best, you let something slip by you, and Op Team 7 paid for that laxity with their lives. At worst, you're to blame for what happened.
No.
Mark pushed away from the desk, shaking his head, confused and angry at what he was hearing. That's not it.
He looked up. This mission was a setup, man. They were waiting for us on the Palomino. They had that guy with the grenade launcher positioned to mop up any survivors. It was an ambush, plain and simple.
It does look that way, doesn't it? Conveniently, there's no way for us to access the remains of the truck for any data recordings, Wells shot back. So if someone warned the targets, we need to start looking for a penetration here at MI6.
Yes, said Mark, and he was thinking of Sam again, of her warning.
I'm glad we're on the same page.
Mark's thoughts suddenly caught up to Wells' implication, and he glared at him.
You're accusing me.
I never said that.
He leaned across the table, staring defiantly at the other man, and in that moment, all he wanted to do was punch Wells in the face.
I came back, damn it. Why would I come back if I was part of this?
That's a good question. Considering how you were silent for over 24 hours, how you covertly re-entered the country without any service oversight.
I told you, he shouted. I had no choice.
So you keep saying.
Wells matched him, speaking over his words. But come on, Dane. If you really wanted to, you could have phoned the front desk, but you didn't. Instead, you went dark for an entire day.
He let that hang in the air for a moment.
You're not a fool. I mean, you appreciate how that looks, don't you?
Mark felt sick inside as the understanding washed over him.
You weren't there. You don't understand.
He forced the wellspring of fear in him down and away, working hard to keep his voice level.
If I betrayed my team to Al-Saif or the Combine, he bit out every word, if I did that, why the hell would I walk back into the cross and surrender to you?
I can think of some reasons. Wells looked away, musing. Maybe the people you sold out to double-crossed you, and you've come crying back to us. Maybe you screwed up so badly you thought you would cut your losses. Maybe you're not as clever as the psych file says you are.
Mark shook his head, incredulous. Where are you getting all this? Don't you want to know who was behind the explosion? Why they chose to hit Nomad? Doesn't any of that matter to you?
Annoyance flashed briefly in Wells' eyes. Don't tell me how to do my job.
We have people working on those things right now. Those questions will be answered. All elements of this misadventure will be fully analysed.
Misadventure? He spat the word back across the table. Don't talk about it like it's a bad fucking football result. I saw them all die over there, my teammates,
You're what?
Wells seized on his outburst. He manipulated something on the data pad's screen, and from the corner of his eye, Mark saw Sam's face appear on the display.
Did you think that we didn't know, Dane? About you and Green?
Mark stiffened, and suddenly he could find nothing to say.
We knew, Wells continued. That's our job up on 9, to know about that sort of thing.
He leaned in. Did you get close to her because she was one of Op Team 7's senior field officers? Did you think that would help you somehow?
Wells's cell phone bleated, and he pulled it out of his pocket. His expression soured, and he shot a glance at the security camera before dismissing the call.
You're way out of line, Mark told him, low and cold.
I don't know what you thought was going on there, said the other man. But you were not the first liaison Green had within the service. She was quite the free spirit.
The phone rang again, and this time Wells switched it off, but Mark wasn't seeing him anymore. He was thinking of the dream, of a night in Camden, of fire and smoke and blood on a bleak French dockside.
I don't know anything about that, said Mark in a dead voice.
Wells was going to say something else, but then the magnetic lock on the door buzzed, snapping open, and one of the security guards was standing there.
Sir, he said, you need to step outside for a minute.
Mark's interrogator frowned.
All right, let's take a break. As I see, I won't get any peace until I deal with this.
He stood up and leaned in to gather up his pad.
We're just having a warm-up chat anyway,
he told him. I'll come back in 20 minutes. Take the time to have a think about your situation while I'm gone. The door slammed, and Mark was suddenly surrounded by silence.
What the hell do you think you're doing in there? Royce's voice cracked like a whip,
and Talia found herself glancing along the corridor outside the conference room, afraid that someone of higher rank would happen on the confrontation.
My job, Wells replied without apology.
He strode away, forcing them to keep up. Talia and Royce had been allowed to watch the so-called interview from an observation room down the hall, but the mission director's tolerance for Wells's style of questioning soon ran thin. When he ignored his calls, Royce stormed out and demanded an explanation.
I won't have you trying to bully a confession from one of my officers, said Royce.
Wells raised an eyebrow. I haven't even got the thumbscrews out yet.
How does some suspected relationship between two consenting adults have anything to do with the Palomino explosion?
Royce demanded. Oh, believe me, there's nothing suspected about it, said Wells. And you know full well the regulations about office romances.
As if you don't have enough dirty pictures on file already, Royce shot back. My operatives are all professionals. They're not compromised by the kind of sordid insinuations you're making.
What exactly does that mean, Donald, that you turn a blind eye to shagging in the ranks as long as it doesn't impact on mission performance? They reached the elevator bank, and Wells turned to stare at him.
Pretty much, yes.
Royce gave the other man a challenging glare in return. The op teams keep their own houses in order. I keep a loose rein on my crews because they're bloody good at what they do. I trust them, and I don't like you playing games with one of my men for your own amusement. If you have proof of misconduct, show it to me.
I really don't care what you like, Wells replied with a sniff. Your, what did you call it? Your loose rein may have compromised an entire mission. Dane belongs to me now, and I will question him any way I want to. If I want to mess with his head by bringing up his dead girlfriend, I'll do it.
He pointed a finger in Royce's face.
I don't answer to you, Donald. I answer to Control, and Control wants facts.
He nodded back in the direction of the conference room.
I'm going to get the facts, the proof, and you are going to stay out of my way. I paid you the courtesy of letting you know your man was still alive, but now we're done. If he's innocent, you'll get him back. If not...
He let the sentence hang. The elevator arrived, and he turned to walk in. But Royce pushed past Talia and stepped into Wells's path.
Victor, he said firmly, don't take your personal dislike of me out on one of my operatives. Perish the thought.
Talia could stay silent no longer and spoke up.
Mark Dane is a good asset. He's risked his life for this country on dozens of occasions and as a naval officer before he came to the service. He's not a traitor. He doesn't, she halted, floundering to find the right words. He just doesn't have that in him.
I'm sure they said that about Philby, too.
Wells spared her a look.
All this impassioned support for your man is very touching, but it doesn't change anything. There's an undeniable truth here that the committee and I both agree on, which you have to accept.
Which is? Asked Talia, dreading the answer.
Mark Dane survived an attack that blew up half the Dunkirk docks, when by rights he should have been killed along with the rest of the Nomad team. That fact alone means that he should be treated with suspicion.
He stepped around Royce and into the lift.
Green, Ricks, Nash, Taub, Davis, Bell and Marshall.
Wells reeled off the names like a litany.
We owe it to all of them to be certain where the blame for their deaths lies.
I'm a fool, Mark told himself.
Of everything he had expected to occur when he returned to London, somehow it had never occurred to him that he would be blamed for all of this. He was just one of the blokes in the van, watching screens and working the tech. This kind of thing didn't happen to him. His thoughts were churning, pulling him in different directions. The events of the past day were repeating, merging with flashes of memory. Questions Mark had never wanted to answer, now pushing themselves to the front of his mind. He felt afraid and alone, and it was a new kind of dread that was totally alien to him.
Once upon a time I was so fearless.
Where the hell did that go? That was the past, when there had been nothing to lose. But then there was the helicopter crash, and then the service, and Sam. His perspective had changed. And now all that was slipping away from him. The door opened and he jerked upright in the chair, startled.
Hey, Mark.
Welcome back to Legoland. The last thing he expected to see was a friendly face. John Farrier stepped into the room and sat in the chair that Wells had vacated. He gave him a wan smile. The other man was 6 years Mark's senior, and he wore all his experience in the lines around his eyes and the hawkish cast of his face. One of the very first op-team crew leaders, Farrier had been a mentor for the younger man during Mark's training. He had a solid reputation as a veteran, non-official cover officer, one of MI6's lone wolf operatives. It was Farrier who had recruited Mark back at the start.
Mate, he told him gravely, you look like shit.
Mark gave a dry chuckle.
Nice to see you too.
Farrier frowned.
I know all about it, Mark. Patel brought me in to run top cover for the clean-up.
He shook his head. What the hell happened?
Did Wells send you?
Mark asked, hesitating as the thought occurred to him. Are you going to be the good cop?
That oily little prick, Farrier snorted. He'd have kittens if he knew I was in here.
He nodded at the door. I'm not supposed to be within a mile of you, but I've got pull. Farrier pointed at the camera eye. The red active light above it was dark.
I called in a marker with someone in monitoring. That's going to stay off for a while.
He leaned forward. I wanted to talk to you. Let you know you're not being cut adrift by everyone.
Feels that way, said Mark.
I had nothing, John. And they had shooters out after me.
He ran out of breath.
They killed them. Sam, she died right in my arms.
Who's they? Asked Farrier, as that sank in.
The Tangos, Al-Saif, or whoever they were working with. The one that came for me was German, I think.
Farrier shook his head.
If it was Al-Saif, they'd have told the whole world by now. Get us into shit with the French for operating on their turf. Not a peep yet, though.
The Combine, then, Mark went on, the one supplying their weapons.
He looked up and saw Farrier watching him.
What?
The other man's frown deepened.
Wells has got a serious hard-on for you, Mark.
You know he has an axe to grind with Royce, and he's never liked the op-team program right from day one.
You might have been better off staying dark than coming in like you did.
What else could I have done?
Farrier didn't answer that.
He's gearing up to put the frame around your neck for this.
Mark nodded once, feeling hollow inside.
I'll guess that much. He hated the way his next words made him sound weak and powerless.
Can you help me?
Farrier looked away. I shouldn't even be here. I'm jumping the fence. Supposed to be going to diplomatic official cover at the embassy in Rome. Security deployment.
He straightened his jacket, his voice turning distant. I'm already a day late.
Right. I get it. Mark's throat went dry. I'm not part of it, John.
You believe me when I say that, don't you?
Farrier nodded without hesitation. Of course I do. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. But I wanted to warn you. Wells is going to press hard, harder than you've ever had to deal with before.
I'm not afraid of him.
He said the words without conviction, and the other man saw it. You should be, Farrier told Mark. He's not stupid, and he's got a lot of clout.
He fell silent, as if he had said more than he meant to.
What are you not telling me? Mark demanded.
Farrier's sudden, uncharacteristic reticence was ringing alarm bells in his head.
Wells put in for JIC authorization to move you to a secure location. A country house.
Where?
Don't know. He's playing it close to his chest. But they gave it to him.
Country house was a typically mocking service euphemism for what was more commonly known as a black site. Undisclosed detention facilities. Some of them in allied countries with markedly less interest in human rights than the United Kingdom. Others hidden in plain sight at military facilities across the rural counties.
If Mark vanished into one of those sights, it would be as if he had fallen off the face of the world. Wells had him as the chief suspect of an investigation into the suspected breach of the op team hierarchy, and once he was off-grid, Mark would be processed. Another bland term with a darker meaning. The kinds of forceful interrogation utilized in a black site were not bound by any but the most cursory rules of conduct. Someone very high up the ladder is extremely pissed off about what happened in France, Farrier was saying. They want a swift resolution and a body to swing from the gallows.
That's not me, Mark insisted. I'm not to blame for this.
Then who is?
Careful who you trust, Sam had told him. But if not Farrier, then who?
He was running out of options.
Wells is right, he began, the words spilling out of him. There's been a penetration. Someone inside the security services with connections to the Combine. I think it has to be someone at operational level or above. That must be why Nomad was targeted. That's why... Sam's name was on his lips, but before he could say more, the door buzzed angrily, and Wells's security officer pushed into the room.
That's enough, he said, eyes darting back toward the corridor. You're done here, Farrier. Get out.
No, wait, Mark's voice caught. Not yet, damn it.
Farrier gave him a look. Give me 2 more minutes.
No minutes, no waiting.
The guard's voice became a snarl as he pressed a hand to his head where a coil of cable led to the black comma of a radio earpiece.
Wells finds out you were here, and no amount of favours I owe you will be enough. Out.
Farrier stood up, turning back to give Mark a look that he couldn't read. Stay strong, be smart, he told him. That's what you're good at. And then, very deliberately, the other man tapped the back of the chair twice with his index finger.
Come on, snapped the security officer, and shoved Farrier through the door, slamming it closed.
On an impulse he couldn't be sure of, Mark leaned forward and looked at the seat cushion where Farrier had been sitting, catching a glint of metal. He reached down, and his hand came back with a silver ring, the diameter of a large coin. Hanging from it was a black plastic fob that resembled the kind of electronic keys used on the majority of modern cars. On one side was a small solar panel, on the other a square button. 3 white LED emitters protruded from the opposite face. Was this Farrier's way of trying to help him? Mark quickly concealed the key fob inside the elastic cuff of his hoodie and leaned back into his chair. He glanced up at the security camera just as the red light winked on, and he looked away, turning over Farrier's words in his mind.
I'm on my own.
He said the words aloud to fix them in his thoughts, and for a moment the panic rose a little inside him, coming up like a slow, inexorable flood tide. But then he thought about Sam and the nameless gunman who had tried to choke the life from him. He thought about the Palomino and the people who were already dead, and slowly he pushed the cold sense of dread away. They came for him soon after, 3 men in black suits and identical glowers, the look of ex-police officers about them. Mark knew the type well enough, and didn't give them any resistance, as they secured his wrists in front of him with a pair of rigid cuffs. Wells watched, his expression neutral.
I think it's better for everybody if we continue our discussion somewhere else. These gentlemen will take you to a secure location. I'll be along later, and we'll resume.
What's wrong with this place? Mark returned, never breaking the other man's gaze.
Emotions are running a little high here, don't you think?
Wells shrugged.
Might be better to get some distance. No chance of interruptions, that sort of thing.
Mark studied his interrogator, trying to get a read on him. He decided to take a chance.
There's something I didn't tell you.
That got Wells's attention.
Oh?
He threw the security men a look, and they hesitated, waiting for a word of command. Do go on. Sam Green knew there was a penetration of MI6 before the mission began. She told me she was investigating it.
There's no record of anything like that, Wells replied dismissively,
and op-team field officers don't look for leaks, that's my job.
This was off book, don't you get it?
That's why we were ambushed. Someone knew Sam was sniffing around, so they took action. Was this her female intuition, or did Green have any actual evidence? Mark's lips thinned. I honestly don't know. That was almost the truth, but she had suspicions. I think I could... Wells folded his arms. That's your best play, is it? Throw out some vague comments from a woman too dead to confirm them. He turned to one of the men. Please, give me the keys. I'm so convinced I'm going to release Mr. Dane here right away. Wells, listen to me. Suddenly the other man was prodding Mark in his chest, his face tight with annoyance. No, you listen to me. I don't like anything you have said since you rolled up. Don't you think we've already got men sifting through everything Green and Ricks and the rest of Nomad left behind? I know what you and Royce think of my department. Now you're going to watch it in action. You've got it all wrong. We'll see, Wells sneered and stepped back. I'm going to put you in a deep, dark hole and lean on you until I get what I want. Even if I don't have what you want? Mark shot back. Wells gestured to the security officers. Get him out of here. Make sure he doesn't talk to anyone. The three men formed up around Mark and marched him to the elevator bank, where a lift was waiting. He saw Wells's face vanish from sight as the doors slid closed, and then they were on their way down toward the building's secure parking garage on the sublevels. When the elevator doors opened, he was marched out toward a glossy black Range Rover. The vehicle sat low on its shocks, a clear sign that it was reinforced with bulletproof glass and sidewall armor. But even with the car's opaque windows, it would blend easily into city traffic. Just one more Chelsea tractor. The back door was open for him, and he took the center seat, pressed in on both sides by two of his minders. The third man climbed in behind the wheel, and the Range Rover rumbled into life, rolling away from the curb toward a ramp leading to street level. Through the windscreen, Mark glimpsed a widening chink of daylight up ahead as a heavy security gate began to slide open. Wells had been right, after a fashion. Mentioning Sam and her suspicions had been the last card Mark had, and the investigator's reaction had told him all he needed to know. Working in the service made you suspicious. It came with a job, where conviction was a rare coin, when the people you met out in the world could easily be there to burn you. But now Mark was seeing deceit on the faces of everyone around him. The people he could trust, the people he had trusted, all of them were now dead and gone. Maybe Wells was the one responsible for that, or maybe he was doing just what he was supposed to, searching for the weak link inside the service. Either way, the man would never give Mark the benefit of the doubt. He looked down at the black metal encircling his wrists. If Sam and the others had been right, if there really was a traitor in the ranks at MI6 who had cold-bloodedly sent them off to perish, then Mark Dane was a clear and present danger to that person, a potentially lethal threat to their safety. Mark had come back to headquarters because he believed he would be safe, following some sort of blind animal instinct to run for the lair, but now his life was narrowing toward two equally unpalatable conclusions. He would either be made to take the fall for what had taken place in Dunkirk, or he would be silently erased before anything he knew could have an impact on the plans of the Combine and their insider. There was a third path, but he had no idea of where it would lead him, or how far it would go. 8. The Range Rover's engine growled as the car sped out onto Albert Embankment, turning tightly into the near side lane. Mark watched the buildings flash past as they headed northwards along the line of the Thames. He tried to build a mental picture of the route they would take, out of the city, to the London Orbital Motorway, and then, where? They were less than an hour away from the nearest airfield, where a courier jet could pick him up for a discreet cross-border rendition. But Mark had his doubts about that. Wells wanted to interrogate him in person, and Mark didn't think he would go to the trouble of following a detainee to a secret prison in another nation. Not when there were facilities within the UK, where he could do as much and still be able to make it back to Mayfair for drinks at his club. No. They would take Mark to a holding location, some hole in the ground built during the Cold War to resist a barrage of Soviet nukes. Just a door in a hillside at the end of a footpath. There were more of those places than people knew, repurposed after the fact. They passed Lambeth Palace and the car slowed as the traffic started to thicken. Mark looked up across the river and saw the tower of Big Ben through the dull afternoon. He didn't make it obvious, but with his peripheral vision he took the measure of the guards. The driver was bull-necked, and he had the nose of a pub brawler, broken more than once and unevenly reset. He wore a pair of glasses that rested awkwardly on his face. On Mark's right was the man who had let Farrier in to talk. He had a heavy brow, deep-set eyes, and the smell of cologne about him. He caught Mark's eye and gave him a loaded look, a silent warning not to mention his earlier indiscretion. Mark considered that for a moment, wondering if he could use it to his advantage. But nothing sprang to mind, and he discarded the thought. The third man was dark-skinned, with a shaven head and a well-maintained beard, and he kept a wary eye on the lines of vehicles around them. Mark was certain that they were armed. All of the security officers had more body mass than Mark's spare, wiry frame, each built heavy to intimidate and project threat. But they were different kinds of men to the operatives that usually Mark worked with. They were reactive, just on the right side of thuggery to be considered professionals instead of common heavies. He thought hard about the third path. This was it, right here and right now. Mark was at the fulcrum of a point of no return, the tension of it turning around him, and what he did in the next few minutes would be critical. He could wait until they were out on the motorway and look for an opportunity there, but that felt wrong. It felt like the weak choice. London was the better option. In the city he could blend in and fade, at least for a little while. And there was something he still needed to do here. He began to regulate his breathing as the Range Rover drove by St. Thomas's Hospital, the engine note falling as the vehicle continued to decelerate. Up ahead, traffic threaded around the Plaza Hotel roundabout leading onto Westminster Bridge. The approaches to the junction were full of double-decker buses, delivery vans and cars, steady but sluggish, picked up from the feed roads and let off to cross the river or pass under the rail bridge out of Waterloo Station. Mark angled his hands so his right thumb hooked on the edge of his pocket where the key fob was concealed. Through the fabric of the tracksuit trousers, he pressed the small device up into his fingers and palmed it. The Range Rover halted, joining a line of cars ready to cross the roundabout. Hemmed in on one side by the high flank of a bus, Mark let his hand slip toward the press button release for the seatbelt. He counted to three, head down, just barely able to see the glow of the traffic lights from the corner of his eye. Red, red amber, green for go. The car rocked as the driver pressed on the accelerator pedal, and Mark made a sudden turn of his head, as if he had seen something out of the left side of the Range Rover. The first guard reacted without conscious thought, turning to look in the same direction, wary of danger. In the same second, Mark hit the seatbelt release, screwed his eyes tightly shut, and pointed the key fob at the face of the guard on his right, mashing the button on the device with his thumb. The triple LEDs gave off a sudden, dazzling flash of light, a million candle power strobe that instantly blinded the man. The light was so harsh it was like needles in his head, even through Mark's eyelids, but he ignored the pain and the dancing blobs of purple across his vision. Blinking away the after images on his retina, Mark surged forward towards the driver's seat and grabbed at the edge of the steering wheel, jerking it savagely to the right. The driver was too slow to fight him, and the margin was too narrow to matter. The Range Rover's tires screeched as it suddenly veered across the road and broadsided the bus with a grinding crash. The impact blew out the emergency airbag in a cloud of dust, battering the driver into his seat. Mark rocked backward as the Range Rover's speed bled away. The other guard was scrambling to grab him, but he was a big guy, and even the back seat of the SUV was a tight fit for the three of them. Mark propelled his elbow down at the man's throat and hit him hard. He lolled forward, choking. Mark turned into a wild punch thrown by the blinded guard, and it rang bells inside his skull. The blow was just a glancing shot, the other man still dizzy, and Mark realized that if the heavy haymaker had connected full on, it would have been all over for him. Scrambling, he threw himself against the dark-skinned man. He connected with the guard's nose and felt bone snap. Blood gushed from the other man's nostrils in a crimson fan. The Range Rover rocked and stopped abruptly. A dull thud vibrating through the framework as it collided with a concrete bollard on the far side of the street. Outside, a chorus of shouts, car horns, crunches of glass, and the sounds of shunted metal began to build as the traffic knotted and clogged. The driver was dazed, dusted with white powder from the airbag ejection system. Mark's joints lit with pain from the impact he had taken, but he swallowed it down and lunged a second time, tearing at the man's jacket, ripping open the inside pocket. He found the stubby metal key rod that would open the mag lock of the handcuffs and a leather wallet. He wanted to look for a weapon too, but he hesitated and lost the chance.
"You piece of shit."
Mark felt a tug as one of the guards in the back grabbed at him, catching the hood of his top and pulling hard on it.
"Come here."
He still had the key fob in his fingers, and he pointed it under his arm, pressing the button again. The second time around, the flash burst wasn't nearly as powerful. The internal capacitor of the device barely recharged, but it was still enough to get a snarl of pain from the man he had already near blinded once. Mark scrambled over the empty front passenger seat and shouldered open the door, falling forward out of the Range Rover and into a heap on the asphalt. He heard cloth rip as the hood was torn away, flaps of it hanging ragged around his shoulders. An arena of stalled cars and trucks were all around, the path to the bridge blocked by the bus the car had collided with. Mark sprinted toward the road that passed under the railway bridge into the shadows beneath. Bus passengers meant people with cell phone cameras, and he didn't want them splashing his face across 100 social networking sites before he even took a step. He knew the security men were coming after him, so he didn't waste time chancing a look over his shoulder. Instead, he fled around the curve of the road and followed it up toward the taxi ranks outside Waterloo Station. As he ran, he released the cuffs and tossed them away, along with the remnants of the hoodie. He slowed as he crossed the road, weaving around a black cab whose driver showed his displeasure with a loud combination of horn and expletives. Mark looked at the windows of the taxi, and in the reflection, he saw figures a few hundred meters behind him, racing to catch up on his lead. Up the stone stairs and through the Victory Arch, across the main entrance, Mark moved into the station proper, forcing himself to slow to a walking pace. If he ran, he would stand out like a flare on a dark night, and Waterloo was heavy with coppers. The rail terminal was close to a police station, so there was always a blue uniform somewhere in his sightline. He ducked into a booking office and stood before a ticket machine, using the moment to search the wallet he had stolen from the driver. He took the money, £50 in crumpled tens and fives, and left the wallet on top of the machine. When he came out, two security officers were already on the concourse, sweeping slowly through the pre-rush-hour crowd in his direction. He cursed when he saw the third, the man whose nose he had broken. With one hand, the guard was holding a red-stained handkerchief to his nostrils, and with the other, he was showing a police officer the screen of his smartphone.
"And my picture."
Mark needed an exit vector, and he needed it quickly. A cluster of noisy teenagers carrying sports bags passed in front of him, and Mark fell in step with them. Behind their cover, he made it all the way to the entrance of the pharmacy on the far side of the concourse. A risky solution was taking shape in his thoughts, but he went with the impulse. Mark knew he had only moments to find a way out. He didn't have time to second-guess himself. Inside the pharmacy, he bought a bottle of water, a pack of lithium batteries, a stubby, travel-sized can of aerosol deodorant, and some condoms. From there, he slipped across to a coffee stand and deftly snatched a stainless steel travel mug from a souvenir display. He had to misdirect his pursuers, and as quickly as possible. It had worked for him in Dover, and it could work now. It was a basic rule of tradecraft: vary the pattern, deceive the watchers. Holding his purchases close to his hip, he walked on. Mark willed himself to blend in, to stay unremarkable and unseen as he counted down the seconds before he was through the door and into a nearby gastropub that faced out onto the train platforms. A sign told him the toilets were tucked behind the bar. He threaded between the tables, pausing to grab a metal knife off an uncleaned food plate. He vanished into the gents, locking himself in a stall. If they came at him in the next few minutes, he would have no way out. He was taking a big risk. but it was all a calculated gamble now. Given how near they were to Vauxhall Cross, given what Mark knew about the response times of the security services, they would have a net thrown over Waterloo less than 15 minutes after the initial alert call went out. Acting quickly, Mark filled one of the condoms with water and suspended it inside the cap of the travel mug. The knife was blunt, but it had enough of an edge to cut into the casing of the batteries, and he sawed at them until he exposed the grey lithium within. The broken batteries went into the mug along with a little aerosol can, and he carefully clamped the modified cap back in place. He hesitated, holding his breath to listen. He was still alone. On impulse, he chugged the rest of the water and tossed the plastic bottle aside before giving his improvised device a sharp shake and setting it atop the toilet cistern. A thin wisp of white smoke emerged from an air hole in the top of the travel cup. Then Mark was walking away, out of the men's room, crossing the bar, forcing his stride to stay casual and unhurried as he made for the exit. Speed and confidence were key. If you were fast enough, if you seemed assured about it, you could get a long way before someone looking right at you had caught what you were doing. He was at the door when the exothermic reaction between the water and the lithium became hot enough to burn through the pressurized aerosol canister. There was a loud, flat bang of combustion from the toilets and the sudden acrid stink of burning chemicals. A second later, the shrill clarion of the pub's smoke alarm sounded. Everyone in the room was on their feet, moving, at the edge of panic. Londoners had seen enough bombs on their streets over the decades, enough that the fear of more was an excellent motivator. Mark allowed himself to be carried out with the pub patrons, and he crossed the eyeline of a policeman and kept on going. Hurried but utterly normal, he turned and walked down to the escalators leading to Waterloo's underground station. Still nothing, no cry of alarm, no shouts of stop him. 2 minutes later, he was on a northbound tube. As the doors closed and they began to roll away, Mark was certain he glimpsed the guard with the busted nose on the platform. But then the tunnel blacked out the sight of the man, and he was away. Free and clear. For now.
At the committee level, the decor of Vauxhall Cross abruptly shifted from the modernist, minimalist style of the lower floors to something closer to the halls of a gentleman's club. The carpets were richer, the walls panelled with polished wood, the chairs upholstered with oxblood leather. Royce self-consciously straightened his tie as he crossed the small anteroom outside the office of the deputy director, slowing to a halt. The director's secretary, a bullish woman, with the face of a sour old aunt, peered over the top of her monitor and nodded once. "Go right in," she told him. "You're expected." He took a breath and turned the brass handles, stepping into the room beyond. Tall windows with a greenish-gold tint filled one wall of the office, looking out over the Thames towards Millbank. They framed a massive Regency desk the size of a small car, hemmed in on both sides by floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. Behind the desk, the deputy director looked up from a sheaf of papers bearing the UK Eyes Alpha imprint and inclined his head toward a chair.
"Sit," he commanded.
Royce did as he was told. "Sir Oliver," he began, but the other man waggled a finger at him, and he fell silent. Sir Oliver Finch Shortland was one of the most powerful men in the British intelligence community, a scion of a family that had served the Crown since the Wars of the Roses, up through the formation of the SOE during the Second World War and on into the new millennium. Of average height, he was well past the back end of his 50s. Finch Shortland had a narrow aspect that was all sharp angles, and in his younger years it had lent him a wolfish quality. These days, he didn't show his fangs so often, but when he did, it was clear he had lost little of the strength that had made him. Behind his back, they called the deputy director the old dog, and that was as much as a joke as it was a warning about his bite. He put down the files. Sir Oliver refused to read anything that wasn't presented to him on paper, and turned a leaden glare on Royce.
"I really don't enjoy interfering on a departmental level, Donald. I try to find people who can do the job without me looking over their shoulders. And that's you."
"Thank you, Sir Oliver,"
He ignored the reply. "That's you," he continued. "If you don't make a right balls up of the whole thing."
The deputy director prodded the papers on his desk with a thin, well-manicured finger.
"Dear God, man. A dozen suspects and an entire team of officers blown to pieces. This sort of thing does not happen to us."
His lips thinned.
"Oh, this sound and fury. That's not how we operate. That's not how I want my subordinates to operate."
"Sir," the finger came up again.
"And then, I'm told you have a man, a survivor of this catastrophe, a potential turncoat, no less, who slips the net no more than a mile or so down the street from this very building."
Finch Shortland's voice shifted as he spoke, becoming a harsh snarl.
"I relish the moment when I will have to relay that little detail to the PM and the rest of the Cabinet Office."
When Royce didn't say anything, the deputy director gave him a terse flick of the wrist.
"You can speak now. And what I want to hear are answers and not excuses."
Royce took a breath and launched in.
"The officer in question is Mark Dane, a mission support specialist from Op Team 7, the group compromised in France. He got away from three of Wells's men, setting off a small, improvised firebomb to cover his escape. Our colleagues at MI5 are assisting. They've seized all closed-circuit camera footage and are sifting it now for leads."
"Much to their amusement, no doubt. Have you given 5 the full story? They do so enjoy seeing their sister agency being made to look foolish."
"I'm not about to tell our friends at Thames House any more than they need to know, sir. Dane's identity has been flagged at all borders, and the Met have him on a watch list. We've given them the standard cover. Anti-terror investigations, that sort of thing."
The other man brought his hands together, the fingers forming a steeple.
"This fellow, his escape from custody represents a serious failure on the part of your staff, you and Wells."
"With all due respect, Sir Oliver, I didn't want Dane taken off the premises for debriefing in the first place. We could have done that here."
Finch Shortland's grey eyes flashed.
"I hope that wasn't a veiled I told you so, Donald. I tire easily of any interdepartmental politicking in the service. We leave that kind of game-playing to the Americans. Do you understand?"
"I'm just stating a fact," Royce replied smoothly. The deputy director gave a soft grunt and leaned back in his chair, the leather creaking.
"Don't sweeten the pill. How serious is this?"
Royce let out a slow breath. He had been dreading this moment. "It would seem that the concerns we had about the possibility of a penetration of the op team structure were not unfounded. I'm afraid we have to consider that MI6 may have a Combine asset within it."
"Those damned gunrunners. How can we be certain?"
"That question is ongoing, sir. Right now, all we have is circumstantial evidence."
"I wouldn't call a man instigating a road accident and assaulting 3 security staff circumstantial."
"We don't have a full picture of Dane's mindset," Royce went on. "He was at the center of a very traumatic incident. There's a possibility..."
"I know he's one of yours," said the deputy director. "But be clear-eyed about this. He ran."
He paused.
"How exactly did he do that, by the way? Dane's a button pusher."
Royce bristled. "Not exactly. That's the mistake that Wells and his men made, considering him nothing more than a field technician, but Dane has training, aptitude. His former Royal Navy."
"Perhaps he had outside help."
"I don't think so, sir."
Royce paused, considering. "Frankly, I think his escape proves Mark is more resourceful than any of us gave him credit for."
"Well, do remember to give the lad a gold star after we clap him in irons."
Finch Shortland shook his head, glancing down at the papers.
"It says here he blinded one of the men guarding him."
Royce reached into his pocket and placed a black key fob on the desk. He used one of these. It's part of our covert devices suite, a less-than-lethal flash unit. At close quarters, it can give off a burst of extremely high-intensity light, strong enough to overload the human optic nerve for a short period. The other man eyed the key fob warily.
Where did he get it?
I don't know, Royce admitted. There's no record of Dane being issued one for the Dunkirk mission.
But what he did, well, that shows forethought, doesn't it? He planned and executed an escape on the fly from right under our noses. We trained him, after all. He must have had an idea about our protocols, where he was going.
Maybe that's why he ran, offered Royce. Finch Shortland gave a low sigh.
I know you will be reluctant to admit there was a weak link in your department, but I've read Wells's report. Dane was under the shadow of suspicion the moment he came through the door. If he didn't have anything to fear, he had no reason to flee.
Again, with respect, I hope you're wrong, Sir Oliver. Dane is intelligent, but he's not experienced. This could just be an extreme reaction to an extreme situation.
We can judge his state of mind once he's under lock and key. The last thing we need is a rogue officer on the loose.
Royce had more to say, but the intercom on Finch Shortland's desk gave a strident buzz.
Sir Oliver, said the secretary's voice. What is it, Judith?
Mr. Royce's aide is here. She says it's urgent.
Send her in.
Royce stood up as Talia entered. She looked stressed and shot him a concerned look.
I'm so sorry to interrupt.
She offered Royce her data pad.
A preliminary report just came in from the information surveillance desk at 5. I thought you would want to see it immediately.
Sir Oliver got up and came around the desk.
This is about the errant Mr. Dane, I take it.
She nodded. MI5's hackers have already set up monitoring of his email accounts and online presence. They found something.
Royce's expression hardened.
There are details of a deposit here in a bank account keyed to Dane's biometric signature, a holding trust in the Cayman Islands.
A new account, totaling $600,000, Talia explained. We've tracked the wire transfer to a bank in Beijing. It's a known shell company.
There's more, said Royce.
Notification of flight bookings under a different name. He handed back the pad to Talia. London to Riyadh. One way.
Saudi Arabia, offered Finch Shortland. Among other things, a nation that has no extradition treaty with the United Kingdom.
He gave Royce a level look.
Tell me, Donald, do you still think Dane is just looking for a bit of breathing room?
He turned away.
Get him back.
At first, Mark thought the message was another one of those fake Nigerian bank scams, the so-called phishing stings that swelled the inboxes of millions of email accounts worldwide. But the message passed through his junk mail filters, and it addressed him personally. It didn't ask him for any personal information. It had that already. The Bright Star Cayman Trust was welcoming Mark Dane to their exclusive client list and asking him if he wanted some advice on where he could invest the six-figure sum with his name on it, which had materialized in their bank. He checked the exact time of the deposit. According to the receipt, the money had changed hands several days before the operation in France. A cold prickle of anxiety crept along the length of his spine. The next message in his unanswered stack just made things worse. It was an e-ticket from Qatar Airways for a business-class flight from Heathrow to King Khalid International under the name of Tom Harley. The Harley identity was a standby snap cover Mark had been issued several months ago, an airtight Belgian passport forged to the usual high standards of the security services. For a moment, he blinked at the text on the little screen before him. He had picked the BlackBerry from the suit pocket of a dozing businessman on the underground, and here in a dingy coffee bar,
with free Wi-Fi access, Mark had dared to chance a look online to gather information. He regretted that now. It had taken a while to get here. First, Mark had doubled back on himself. It was a trick that Leon had told him about, something the old-school spies called washing the route, the act of running in a loop in order to make sure you didn't have a follower. At Euston Station, Mark jumped off the train just as the doors were hissing shut and made his way down to the Victoria Line platform. He rode south, back one stop to Warren Street, and then did the same in reverse, crossing to the Northern Line again and deliberately taking a route through the passages that went against the flow of the commuters. Then he rode two stops past his destination, crossed platforms, and finally emerged from Camden Town Station as evening began to draw in. He was as clean as he could hope to be. But that didn't mean he could relax. Feeling edgy and with a headache threatening to bloom behind his eyes, he bought himself another jacket, a dark, weatherproof, super-dry knockoff, and followed the street toward the nearby canal. The narrow coffee bar was sandwiched between a store specializing in leatherware and a brightly lit frontage that was all glass cabinets full of jeweled mobile phone cases. Finding a table at the back, Mark got himself a cup of strong, mud-colored Kenyan and attacked a thick sandwich, working the stolen BlackBerry's tiny keys with greasy fingers. First, he looked for any traces of his escape on news websites. The improvised bomb had rated a mention on some of the social networks, a line of hashtag conversations rising briefly in the aftermath as commuters complained about the police ordering a temporary evacuation of Waterloo. He sifted the web and social messaging sites using accident, car, bus, Westminster Bridge as a search string, but there was only a cursory mention on a traffic report page. Standard service protocol, he considered. They were keeping things quiet for the moment. He finished the sandwich and then ate another. It hadn't registered with Mark how hungry he had been, how empty inside, not until the smell of fresh cooked food from one of the street vendors had washed over him. He had to remind himself to slow down and not bolt it. But his appetite was dead now, the half-chewed ham and cheese losing all taste in his mouth. The money. The ticket. They were coming out of the shadows to build a case against him. Someone was stacking evidence against Mark that would prove he was the traitor Wells had accused him of being. But as objectionable as the man was, he couldn't believe that Wells would fit him up like this. It had to be the Combine, moving in to deal with him as swiftly as they could. Mark put down the BlackBerry and took a careful sip of the coffee. It was an effort to think straight, to reason it through, and not just react. Dunkirk. The Palomino. The people who destroyed the freighter, the ones who hired the gunmen. They wanted bodies, not a survivor. I broke their plan, Mark told himself. I left the van. If he had stayed, the grenade that murdered Leon and Owen would have killed him as well. They wanted them all dead, every member of Nomad wiped out, and the gunman had been there to make sure it ended that way. The deaths of Op Team 7 would have cut off the undisclosed investigation going on inside the service, at least for a while. Enough time for the asset within the organization to cover themselves, to get away or do something else. What did that mean? He asked himself the question, trying to think like the enemy. It meant that Mark was as much an opportunity for the Combine as he was a problem. He studied the emails again. Both were authentic, but the money and the airline ticket were quick and dirty plays. They lacked subtlety. Whoever was building this frame was taking advantage of an unforeseen situation, scrambling to make him look guilty, putting it all together on the fly. Mark imagined that this was just the start. If he dug deeper, he would probably find a drop somewhere, a lockup or a safe deposit box in his name packed with more incriminating material. It would be easy enough for a group like the Combine to set up something like that. They had money and a long reach. If someone had already decided he was guilty, someone like Victor Wells, then all this would tip the needle further into the red. Wells wouldn't look too hard at the evidence. Why the hell would he want to? Anything Mark said to defend himself
would sound like a vague conspiracy theory, because that was exactly what it was. I am so fucked. It was a second or two before he realized that he had vocalized the thought. A couple of teenagers at a nearby table gave him an arch look, then went back to ignoring him. He didn't notice their attention. All he could focus on was the rising thunder of the blood in his ears, the slow twisting of his gut like a claw reaching into him, tightening with every passing moment. The tide of dread was building, acidic like bile. The food he had eaten was like lumps of lead in his belly. The flood of panic threatened to overwhelm him. He wasn't trained for this. He wasn't an agent. He was a tech guy, a backseater, who had a gun but never fired it in anger. This escape, all of it, had been on blind luck and happenstance. They were going to catch him. He was going to be found and disappeared. Mark put his hands on the table and laid them flat to stop them shaking. With effort, he metered his breathing, staring fixedly at the space in front of him. Inside him, there was chaos, and Mark Dane looked right into it. In the car, at the crash, he had felt himself at a moment of change, and now, here in this unassuming, ordinary cafe, he was feeling that again, but stronger now, far more potent. Fear raced through him, and it wanted to take hold. If he let that happen, he would lose everything. If he let that happen, they would win. In that moment, Mark found what he needed. He reached inward and strangled the panic before it could grow. He thought about the people who wanted him dead, who had killed and lied. By inches, his fear made the slow, inexorable change into resentment. Someone out there, perhaps even someone he knew, had played the members of Op Team 7 as if they were pawns on a chessboard, sacrificing them in a game so big that Mark could only see the edges of it. Questions came to him in a torrent. What had Sam, Ricks, and Nash uncovered? What had they come close to? Who did this? He held his fury for a long moment, examining it. This was not just about his pain at losing Sam or his anger at the deaths of his teammates. Not anymore. I need to know, he told himself. I need to find the truth and prove I wasn't a part of it. And at last, Mark found an understanding that made it all snap cleanly into focus. The Combine and their associates in Al-Saif had done this because they were afraid. They feared what Nomad would discover, perhaps what had already been discovered. The others were dead. And now Nomad was only one man. Nomad was Mark Dane, and they were afraid of him. He nodded to himself. There was nowhere he could go but deeper into the labyrinth. There was no safe path anymore. This was the moment to commit to the risk of it all. I'm going to find out what Sam knew. A slow, glacial calm descended on him. And then I'm going to drag those secrets into the light for the whole bloody world to see. 9. In the dark, the house looked different. Sullen, somehow, robbed of all the warmth and life that he'd known in there with Sam. Mark crossed the road and made his way up the stairs to the front door. Picking the lock was the easy part. The trick was getting inside fast enough to secure the alarm before it activated. He slammed the door shut and pulled open the security panel. In the dimness of the hallway, he was working off nothing but the soft glow of the illuminated buttons and the display. As he punched in the code, Mark tensed. If they had changed the alarm setting for the safe house, he wouldn't know about it until it was too late. No shrilling, screaming sirens would be set off. Instead, a warning would be fed straight back to MI6, and someone would come looking. The alarm setting went from red and armed to green and safe, and Mark blew out the breath he'd been holding in. This would be the last place Wells would think to come looking for him, but that didn't give Mark any excuse to breathe easy. In the shoe caddy by the door there was a false bottom, and beneath it, the same model of Glock pistol he had been issued in Op Team 7.
Mark slid down the wall and sat there on the floor, checking the gun, cocking it. Waiting. 2 hours later, he woke up with a jerk and reflexively pointed the gun at the door, blinking sleep from his eyes. Shit. His voice echoed in the empty hallway. Gingerly, he clicked the Glock's side lock into place and stuffed the pistol in a jacket pocket. The fatigue had come out of nowhere, swept up over him before he even knew it. Angry at his own weakness, he climbed up, wincing at fresh aches in his back. Like an explorer moving through the chambers of a tomb, Mark walked a path from room to room, turning on every light, looking in every corner, switching them off again as he left. His initial impression didn't change. The house seemed like a dead space, still and old. He found the empty wine bottle in the kitchen, where they had left it weeks earlier. The safe house had remained idle all that time, but somehow Mark could sense the ghost of Samantha Green in its spaces. She had come back here since the day they had spent together, he was certain of it. When he found the bag, he knew his instincts were correct. Concealed in a cupboard under the staircase, lost among brooms and a vacuum cleaner, it lacked the layer of dust on everything else. The bag was a black day pack that would not look out of place on an airport luggage carousel. Inside, it had inset panels made of a dense plastic that could smother the terahertz wave signals from metal detectors. Buried among a few changes of shapeless unisex clothes and some toiletries were boxes of ammunition, Ziploc packs of money in pounds, dollars, and euros, a survival knife, and a heavy-duty flashlight. He took the bag into the living room and emptied it methodically, taking inventory of everything in there. In tradecraft, they called this a go-bag, a prepared kit of gear that an operative could gather up and take at a moment's notice if circumstances were turning against them. The clothes were hers, and so were the fake IDs secreted in one of the side compartments. Mark leafed through passports from 4 different countries, each under a different name, each bearing a different picture of Sam looking back at him. Her hair cut short in one, wearing glasses in another, or peering out from under a long wig. The eyes didn't change, though. Her laughing, daring eyes. He sat across from the sofa where they had made love, and listened for the echo of her. This was all he had now, a collection of pieces that were not the real Sam. Mark divided up what he could use from what he would discard, and in the process, something slipped from the folds of a shirt. A metal bar, the length and thickness of his thumb. He recognized it immediately, turning it over in his fingers. It was an iron key, solid-state memory stick. A secure flash drive unit that could hold several gigabytes of data. What made it special was the construction of the stick and the built-in encryption software. Any attempt to crack the casing or break the password protecting the contents through a brute force hack would cause it to permanently erase its contents. He held it in the palm of his hand and studied it. Is this worth killing for? Very carefully, he placed the memory stick on the table in front of him and reached for the packets of money. There were a few credit cards in there as well, and those Mark could make immediate use of. He turned on the stolen BlackBerry one last time. It was a risk using the device again, but he had few options. Mark found an unprotected Wi-Fi connection and started to gather what he was going to need. The drizzle from the showerhead slowed to a trickle. She took a slow breath and held it, running her long-fingered hands up over her scalp and across the dark fuzz of her close-cropped hair. With military precision, Lucy Keys let her breath back out in a slow, silent exhale and reached for the thick towel hanging on the rail near the tub. She didn't bother to rub off the water still clinging to her, coiling the cloth around and over her like a toga. From the corner of her eye, she caught sight of her own face in the wide mirror. Dark as ochre, she was stark against the brilliant white tile of the walls. A boyish face that the short hair accented, sharp-chinned, with eyes that looked sleepy, if you didn't pay attention. The towel concealed a body that was athletic and spare, and it hid other things too. A shallow burn mark on her waist, the pucker of the healed wound from a 9mm bullet. Other scars went deeper, forever out of sight. She gave herself a languid wink and wandered into the bedroom. Lucy was met by a panoramic view of London, dimming now as night made its approach, lights coming on all across the streets below. The window looked down to Hyde Park, and she could pick out the shimmer of the snake-shaped lake that ran the length of the green sward. She made coffee and orbited the suite, thinking over her assignment. Soft carpeting gave under her feet, and she enjoyed the simplicity of the sensation. Sometimes it was important to take a moment for the small things like that, she reflected. When Lucy was growing up in a sparsely furnished apartment in Queens with her mother and brother, she'd been 10 years old before they had anything other than threadbare rugs on the uneven floor. She remembered what seemed like a lifetime of splinters and soles of feet made tough. A suite in the iconic Park Tower Hotel on Knightsbridge was a hell of a long way from those back streets. But Lucy's course through the world had taken a lot of detours like this one, some high, but a lot more low. She was pouring the coffee when she saw that the laptop on the desk was showing a blinking amber light. Biting back a curse, she reached for it and flipped up the screen. The computer had a thick-set, rugged look to it, like it was designed to be dropped out of a transport plane without a parachute. It was military specification hardware, crammed with encryption software and sheathed in a layer of ballistic shell that would stop grenade fragments and low-caliber rounds. Lucy didn't care for all the tech specs, though. It worked when she told it to, and she liked that just fine. Once, in a Brazilian favela, she'd used a similar machine to replace a ceramic armor plate in a combat vest. But that had been a bad day. She'd made it back in one piece. The laptop, not so much. The screen asked her for an access code, and she swiped her finger over an infrared print reader. It took 2 attempts because her hands were still wet, but then the display blinked into a video image. It looked like a small but expensive office, panelled in light wood and brushed steel. Only the oval windows gave it away. She was looking into a room on board a private jetliner, and by the tone of the light through the portals, she guessed it was somewhere over the ocean. A familiar face slid into view.
"Ah, Keys. You grace me with your presence at last."
The man on the screen was tall and pale. He wore fashionable spectacles and an expression that was perpetually arch. His accent was French-Canadian.
"Delancourt," she replied,
deliberately sounding out the name in her New Yorker drawl.
"What's going on?"
The blinking light meant that he had been trying to contact her. The noise of the leisurely shower she had taken must have smothered the sound of the alert chime. He raised an eyebrow, studying her.
"That's an interesting look for you."
Lucy scowled back at the dot-sized camera in the crown of the laptop.
"Like what you see," she dared him.
Delancourt gave a shrug and demurred.
"You're not my type. You know that."
She folded her arms over her chest.
"So, what? We're going early? I'm not due to meet the contact for another 3 hours.
"That assignment has been scrubbed," he told her. "You're being retasked."
Lucy felt the first tingle of anticipation.
"Can I put something on first? Make it quick. He wants to talk to you."
The screen blinked and showed a holding panel, and Lucy walked out of range of the camera, fishing her clothes from the armchair where they lay. She was pulling down a blouse when the display flickered and Echo Solomon stared back out at her. Lucy stiffened and drew into something that was almost but not quite the parade ground attention that had been drilled into her in basic training. Solomon did that to her. Something about the man made her automatically respond with a soldier's deference to a commander. He gave her a shallow nod.
"Lucy, there's been a change of plans."
His voice was careful and resonant. with a clipped diction typical of African-educated English. In person, he was an imposing man, but suave with it. Lucy had never known a moment when he didn't look impeccably dressed or seem perfectly focused. Echo Solomon was one of the richest men in the world, a billionaire with assets across a dozen third-world nations and beyond. His business empire, the Rubicon Group, covered coltan and diamond mines, oil interests, technology, and aviation. But it was a very different element of Rubicon that employed Lucy Keys. On her passport, the real one, that rarely saw the light of day, Lucy's job was listed as security consultant, part of the Rubicon Corporation's Special Conditions Division. That was a pretty way to say she was a private military contractor, what people in the bad old days used to call a mercenary. Once upon a time, Lucy Keys had been First Lieutenant Keys of the United States Army, a Tier 1 recon sniper specialist, part of Delta Force's clandestine all-female F-Squad. But that had been a very different time in her life, and when she dwelled upon it now, she saw a different person back there. Another Lucy, far distant from the one standing barefoot in a 5-star hotel room. Solomon was the reason she was here, and she owed him for that. She owed him for a lot of things. "You wanted me to meet with Hong." She found her voice, becoming businesslike. "That's off?" He gave another nod. "I've passed Mr. Hong to another member of staff to deal with. To be honest, it was probably overkill to send you." "Right." In a way, she had been looking forward to the rendezvous in Chinatown. A quiet meeting, with a compliant asset. A low-to-zero-threat environment. It would almost have been a vacation. "But the information he has, it can wait. I received an urgent call an hour ago from one of our contacts in the British Ministry. An MI6 operation is taking place in London as we speak. An operation relevant to Rubicon's interests." He smiled slightly. "You are in the right place at the right time, Lucy." "In my experience, there's no such thing, boss." She sat on the edge of the bed and turned the laptop to face her, double-checking the active status of the scrambler built into the computer. "MI6 aren't supposed to operate inside the UK. They're external security." "Yes. That gives you an idea of the exigency of the situation." "What's the protocol here?" Lucy gestured absently toward a Walther P99 semi-automatic lying on a bedside table. "Is this a wet job? Do I need my tools?" "Henry has made the arrangements," said Solomon, nodding in the direction of his assistant, who hovered in the background. "Expect a delivery." "Okay," she replied. "Got a target for me?" "You misunderstand," he told her. "This will be surveillance, not tactical." Lucy frowned. "That's not exactly my speciality." "I know." Solomon gave her a smile. "But I need someone I trust to do this. I need to keep the chain of information as short as possible." She accepted this with a nod. "Copy that." Solomon did something out of sight of the camera, and the laptop screen changed to a set of data windows. The video relay shrinking into the corner of the display. The first thing that caught her eye was a picture of a white guy in his 30s, a grainy still pulled from a security camera feed. He was wearing a grubby hoodie, and he looked strung out, tense. Delancourt's voice came over the speakers, echoing and digitizing, where the satellite link lost the edges of the signal bandwidth. He told her that the man in the image was an MI6 intelligence officer who had gone rogue and lost himself somewhere in the city. The Brits were scouring London for him, but they were hindered by the need to do it quietly. "Mr. Solomon has released a considerable amount of assets in order to ensure that Special Conditions Division locate and isolate this man before the British recover him." Henry made a cutting gesture with the blade of his hand. "If MI6 get any hint that we're shadowing him, Rubicon's ability to operate in the United Kingdom will be severely impacted. Copy that, Lucy repeated. She peered at the intel file, scrolling up the screen. Mark Dane, she read aloud. Huh? A support tech? What's so special about him? We need to know what Dane knows, said Solomon. Find him first. Lucy's gaze flicked to the P-99. And after that? We'll review the situation at that time. Be safe, Lucy. There was a crackle of disconnect, and the feed from the jet was cut. She studied the data Delancourt had sent, paging through it, committing Dane's face to memory. A knock at the door brought her out of her focus, and Lucy looked up.
Porter, said a voice. I have a delivery for Miss Locke.
She opened the door. That's me. The porter was holding a medium-sized Louis Vuitton Pullman bag. Hello, miss. This was just brought into the front desk for you. Lucy took the handle and plucked it effortlessly from his hands. Hey. Thanks. Heavier than it looks, said the porter, puffing out of breath. What's in there? Sports gear? She pressed a £5 note into his hand and smiled. Something like that. He camped out in the hallway as the late morning came on, propped on a cushion with the loaded Glock. When the knock came on the front door, it was like thunder, and even though he'd been expecting it, Mark still felt a jolt of shock. He held the door open with the pistol hidden out of sight. The delivery driver offered him a pad where he could sign for the boxes piled on the stoop. Mark made a looping squiggle with a stylus that vaguely resembled a signature, and the man was gone. He made a quick survey of the empty street and recovered his purchases. It had cost a lot to get what he needed on less than 12 hours' notice, but the money wasn't his. It was fairy gold that would evaporate from the cover account in seconds the moment that his MI6 trackers learned of it. He was rolling the dice in a big way here. If Sam's emergency accounts were flagged, what he'd done was hand Wells the location of his hiding place. Before, that sort of risk might have made him hesitate. But not now. Mark had lost something in the last few days, and he was only just starting to realize it. He'd lost some of the fear. Opening the boxes was like Christmas morning. On the heavy wooden table in the kitchen, he unrolled lengths of bubble wrap, unpacking plastic cases and silvery, static-proof bags. He couldn't suppress a small grin as he took stock. There was kit worth thousands of pounds laid out before him, and he was itching to get to grips with it. The largest box contained a fully tricked-out laptop computer, an off-the-shelf Alienware model designed for high-maintenance video gamers with blisteringly fast internet connections. There was an IT techie's toolkit in there as well, and he used it to open the case of the laptop, getting to work on the motherboard within. As he worked, for the first time he found himself thinking about his own place, the clean lines of the small, modern apartment he had out in Docklands. Mark's own personal kit, the computer he had spent months of his life building, was there. His bespoke machine, tuned like a Formula One racing car, sharper than anything in the arsenal of any Tiger Team hacker from Shanghai to Langley. It broke his heart to think of it in the hands of the goons from the ninth floor, who would tear it apart in search of incriminating data. He didn't miss a lot else from the apartment, though. Maybe his Blu-ray collection at a push. Mark had been there for almost 2 years, and there were still cardboard boxes unopened from the move. It had never really been a home for him, not really. It was just a storage area for his stuff, a place to park his body for sleep and food. It didn't have any history to it. It was bereft of ghosts. Mark sighed and pushed those thoughts aside, delving into the guts of the laptop with all the care and seriousness of a cardiac surgeon performing a heart bypass. Kadir poured dark tea into the glass and swirled it slightly, savoring the subtle aroma as a curl of vapor rose from the surface of the liquid. The tea was an ordinary thing, a common pleasure for a soldier, but he treated it as if it were a reward. Kadir had little in the manner of what other men would consider to be vices, but he was not a monk.
He preferred to think of himself as a man of focus and purpose, but not one isolated from the joys of life. Without joy, there was no understanding of what was to be gained, or could be lost. The war would mean nothing without that knowledge. He smiled to himself. In the matter of something as simple as a glass of tea, that truth revealed itself. It was quiet in the compound, save for the occasional mutter of the wind across the windows. Out in the orphanage, the youths were sleeping off the day's instruction. The cycle of training seemed endless to the young ones. But in truth, they were very close to the end of it, to the start of the next phase of the work. Soon the orphanage would be left behind, and those considered strong enough would come with Kadir into the battle proper. There was a knock at the door, and Jadid entered, holding a sheaf of papers.
"Commander," he said,
with the incline of his head that constituted a salute.
"We have confirmation. I thought you would want to be informed immediately."
Kadir allowed his subordinate a nod.
"Show me."
Jadid handed over scans of pages from the previous day's edition of the Washington Post, blurred by fax transmission. He followed the words of the article he was looking for, a grandiloquent piece discussing the subject of American educational reform, and a sneer pulled at the corner of his mouth.
"Our generous friends are proven right once again. Truly we are blessed to have such allies."
He watched the other man sift the vague sarcasm in his tone before he answered.
"They think of themselves as more than that, sir."
Kadir beckoned Jadid to the table and poured more tea for both of them.
"We are blessed, my friend," he told him. "Don't question that. Like the sword, Al-Saif balances on the tip of its blade, ready to sweep up and take the head of the enemy. What we will do shall resonate in history. This will be our most devastating blow against the governments of the West."
Jadid balked at the heat of the tea.
"I do not disagree," he went on, "but I cannot hold my silence. These foreigners, they have plans that do not walk in step with ours."
He was slowly becoming angry.
"Yes, the weapons and the equipment they have supplied to us, those tools have enabled us to do great work, but they—"
He halted, frustrated that he was unable to find the right words.
"They see us in the same way," offered Kadir, "as tools. And when the usefulness of a tool comes to an end, it is discarded."
Jadid gave him a sharp look.
"This is an alliance built on lies, sir."
He smiled coldly.
"Of course it is. These men, this combine, what are they, if not an extension of the enemy we wish to kill?"
He took another sip of tea.
"They are weak men. Greedy men. They desire a world where they can peddle fear to their own kind and live high from it."
He shook his head.
"Men like that, who think themselves our betters, those kind of men can always be used, even as they believe it is they who use us. Our relationship with the Combine is a mutually beneficial one, but when that changes—"
"We will be ready," said Jadid. Kadir nodded again.
"Have no doubt."
Outside in the corridor, there were raised voices, and someone gave an angry shout. A moment later, the door slammed open, and two of Jadid's men entered, dragging a third between them.
"What is this?"
snarled Kadir's subordinate, rising to his feet. He glared at the third man, a husky guard with features marred by a yellow-purple bruise on his face. The man looked up, imploringly.
"We found this one assaulting a recruit," said one of the guards.
His words were laced with disgust,
and the emphasis he placed made it immediately clear what the nature of that assault had been. The guard's gaze flicked back and forth between Jadid and Kadir. He started to babble, trying to explain that it was a misunderstanding. Jadid ignored his pleas.
"You saw this?"
he asked the other guard.
"I saw it," came the reply.
Kadir spoke to them for the first time. He touched his cheek in the same place where the man had the bruise.
"Who did that?"
he asked the question in an offhand, almost casual manner.
"It was me, Commander," said the other guard.
Kadir accepted this.
"Let him stand."
"Sir,"
Jadid shot him a look.
"Do as I say."
The expressions on the faces of the guards turned stony, but they did not disobey. Both men released their grip on the injured man's arms, and immediately he took a step toward Kadir, bringing his palms together in a gesture of thanks. The commander looked the man in the eyes, measuring him for a lie. In the next second, Kadir exploded from his chair with such velocity that his tea glass was knocked aside. His hand went to the holstered Tokarev pistol at his hip, and he drew it out, turning it to present the gun's thick, knurled grip. The butt of the weapon came down like a hammer and shattered the guilty man's nose with the first blow. The second and third impacts cut into his face. Kadir's calm, metered manner evaporated, and he was suddenly towering with anger, crossing between the two extremes in a heartbeat. The man went down in a heap to the wooden floor, drooling blood, weeping like a widow. Kadir drew back his boot and snapped his ribs with a sharp, hard kick.
"Each one of them," he hissed, repeating the blow. "Each is worth 1,000 of you."
He kicked him again, and the guard screamed.
"Sir,"
Jadid's face paled a little with shock at the sudden brutal power of the punishment Kadir delivered. Carefully and deliberately, the commander stepped forward and ground the heel of his boot into the outstretched fingers of the man on the floor. The bones crackled as they broke.
"Get this worthless creature out of my sight," he said, his voice dropping back to an even tone.
Jadid drew his own gun and worked the slide.
"Take him to the basement." "No!"
Kadir shook his head.
"Keep him alive."
He didn't look up as he took his seat again. The matter of the chastised man dismissed immediately from his thoughts as they dragged him away.
"I despise waste."
Kadir frowned at the spilled tea and righted the glass before filling it again. He wasn't aware of the time until he was done. Mark opened a window to vent the smell of hot solder and called the local takeaway for Chinese food. He ate at the kitchen table, foil trays full of egg-fried rice and chicken strips in thick honey-lemon sauce, washed down with a bottle of Tsingtao beer. Debris from his work littered the room, but he ignored it. Wells would come here eventually, and it amused him a little to think of the man being forced to sift through scraps of wire and circuit board as he tried to figure out what Mark had been doing. He took a breath and fished the iron key from his pocket. Mark plugged it into the laptop and watched as the memory stick sniffed at the machine, looking for anything threatening. It asked for a password, and Mark stared at the prompt on the screen. This wasn't one of those things where you got to try again if you screwed up. There was no respawn here like in a video game. If he got it wrong, the solid-state drive would lobotomize itself, and Mark would have nothing. He thought about making a list of possibilities, taking some time to sift his memories of Samantha Green, in hopes of finding the word or phrase that she would have used to lock up this data. He was still thinking that when his hands were on the keys and typing, almost as if it was someone else doing it. The password panel filled up with two words, and his index finger hesitated over the enter key. Camden Market. She loved Camden Market. He pressed the button, and like a hand of cards fanned over a table, the laptop showed panel after panel of data. Files decoding themselves from streams of unreadable gibberish
into legible text. He started reading, eating mechanically. It was all there. Sam's off-book notes about the decision Gavin Ricks had made to look into a possible breach of Op-Team security. There were things here that Mark had never even been aware of. Small-scale missions handled by one or two of the Nomad tactical officers. Stuff that had never been put on the grid at MI6. Investigations that weren't sanctioned. That had originated within Op-Team 7 and contained inside the unit. He tried to read between the lines, but Sam's spare, matter-of-fact notes didn't give him much to work with. Mark wondered where it had all began and drilled deeper. For what seemed like the first time in forever, he felt a surge of confidence. Corridors of data, lines of intel. These things were his battleground. He found the riches in a subfolder full of roughly worded text files. Mark recognized the artifacts of something machine-translated, the rogue adjectives and occasional non sequitur, but it was clear enough to make his pulse race as he read on. A name repeated several times among the dense blocks of words. Dima Novakovich. He knew the man. Not personally, but by the ripples he left, passing through the intelligence network. Novakovich was what the Americans like to call a non-state actor. Not exactly a player on the global scene in the same way as a terrorist or an agent of an aggressor power, but a moving node in the web of influence and action. The man was a criminal, that wasn't in question, but Novakovich was someone of use, and people like him had a way of staying beyond the reach of the world's police forces. He was, for want of a better word, a broker. Mark had first seen his name on a list of middlemen working in Eastern Europe. Novakovich was a Lithuanian national, but stateless by his own choice, one of a breed of extra-legals born out of the rise of the Bratva, the Russian organized crime clans. He liked the high life, expensive hotels and expensive women, and an inclination to roam from resort to resort as the mood took him. Novakovich specialized in the trade of exotic weapons systems, but nothing large enough to put him on hit lists alongside ex-Rocket Corps generals trying to sell surplus SS-20s. No. Dima was a denizen of the dark web, the black market network buried a few layers below the internet that most of the world surfed on. There were email logs here, messages that had been routed through blind servers and back channels. Mark's brow furrowed as he skimmed through them in reverse order. Ricks had been talking to Novakovich for weeks, so it appeared, looking to use him for a way into the structure of the Combine. At first, Mark couldn't pass how the two of them had even got to be talking, but the unfolding narrative of the communications slowly settled into place. The middleman had come to them. Novakovich wanted out. A man like him, even a minor player with his limited skill set, he had to know about the Combine. And he did. More than that, he had worked for them. Mark settled back in his chair, rubbing the fatigue from his face. He let his thoughts settle for a moment. They offered you a step up from the kids' table, didn't they? He looked at the broker's picture on the laptop screen. But you choked. You got scared. By what? He filed that away for later consideration and read on. It was Novakovich who had confirmed what Ricks and Nash and Sam already suspected. That Combine had connections, not just in foreign agencies, but also inside MI6 itself. They were talking about how to extract him, how to make sure he could never be found again in return for spilling what he knew. Mark had to wonder what kind of threat would motivate someone like Dima so forcefully. Could it have been a double game? Mark wondered. The Combine setting up Novakovich as the stalking horse. It was possible. But it seemed more likely that the middleman had got in over his head and started flailing. Deliberate or not, whoever Novakovich was talking about had become aware of what was going on and set up the Dunkirk ambush to deal with the problem. In keeping the investigation off the books, Nomad had unwittingly made it easier to end them.
Mark made coffee and poured the night black liquid into a cracked mug. He set up blinds and proxy routers to mask his digital trail, then punched out into the internet, sifting the anonymous online forums and shadow chat rooms that existed in the non-space of the web. It took him hours, but from a lead he picked up from a Singaporean anti-capitalist forum, he tracked a faceless person who knew someone who knew that Novakovic had gone off the grid in the last few days. The timing couldn't be a coincidence. The broker's business only existed online. He was a fully digital enterprise where buyer and seller never met, a shell game. Money went in one end, and weapons came out the other, clean, neat, and utterly untraceable. But Novakovic was offline. His every virtual storefront shuttered up and silent. He was either dead already, or keeping a low profile. The man was the next link in the chain. Mark studied his face, paging through the file on him that Sam had appended to her notes. Novakovic had a boat, a slick 170-foot superyacht called the Jade, that he liked to sail around the Mediterranean. If he was on board it, he could conceivably stay off the radar for months, moving from port to port and still living in the style to which he was accustomed. That thought lodged in Mark's mind as he looked at a digital still of the broker climbing out of a limousine, a long-lensed shot of Dima with his hand on the shoulder of a woman half his age. Her name was in the notes, Tania Kirin, a Polish émigré with a serious jewellery habit. The file on Tania said she was a dancer, a nicely vague euphemism that covered a multitude of possibilities. The couple had a history of explosive breakups in public places and tearful reconciliations, and these incidents were usually followed by Kirin appearing with a new and bigger rock on her finger. Mark knew right away that the girl was his line to finding the broker. Novakovic wasn't a fool. He knew how to manage his digital footprint, and tracking him would be an uphill struggle. But pretty Tanya, with her costly tastes and shallow manner, someone like her wouldn't take well to being cooped up on a boat for days on end, even if it was a luxury ride like the Jade. Mark started researching the exclusive designers that Tanya Kirin liked to wear, tracking her back until he came upon a trail of ill-kept social networking data. He grinned. It was the motherlode. Within moments he was paging through Tanya's photo stream, watching as the images shifted from cell phone camera snaps of high-end restaurants and sports cars to sunlit pictures from the deck of the Jade. Powder blue skies and dark water. They were out in the deeps. He checked the timestamp. The most recent shot had been uploaded just that morning. Tanya hadn't been good enough to tag the image with her GPS location, but she had engaged in a string of messages with her friends directly afterward. One of them was an event planner who worked for the Atlantis Bay, an exclusive hotel in the town of Taormina. Mark pulled up a map search. The resort was on Sicily's Ionian coast, and it also happened to be home to an artisan who specialized in the Art Deco necklaces that Tanya adored. Gotcha. He leaned back in the chair and took a sip of stale coffee. It was a chancy deduction, a shot in the dark. Mark was basing a lead on the possibility that Novakovic would want to keep his lover sweet by treating her to something new and shiny. He could just as easily be putting two and two together and making five. But was there another choice? Novakovic was off-grid because he was afraid, and with good reason. The Combine didn't like loose ends. The broker was marked, and if Dima was making for Sicily, it was a certainty that he wouldn't stay there for long. Once Novakovic had indulged his lover, the Jade would put to sea again, and there would be no guarantee that Mark would find him. And then there was the other consideration. If Mark could find the man, so could the Combine. When he was done, Mark made a ghost image copy of the contents of the flash drive and recoded it with an encryption to his own recipe. Mark seeded a handful of copies of the files to open access cloud servers and torrent sites out in the shadier corners of the internet, buried them deep under faked names that made the data look like out-of-date versions of office programs or ancient abandonware video games.
Anyone who downloaded the dossiers by chance would get what looked like a corrupt file. Hiding in plain sight in the margins of the net would keep Sam's intel safe. He thought about setting a time release, a countdown clock that would automatically email the data in the clear when the timer reached zero, a digital dead man's switch in case the Combine caught up with him. But who could he trust with this? That question he still couldn't answer. Mark returned to the go-bag and loaded it with the gear he had gathered and made a place to sleep in the living room, close to the window where he could exit quickly. Lights out, and in the dimness, he turned over his next move as the fatigue came on again. He had a new mission now, one he had chosen for himself. In some strange way, that felt freeing. But leaving the country would present challenges of its own. Locating Novakovich meant nothing, unless he could be there to look the man in the eye. Slowly, Mark realized that he would need to call in a favor.